Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today we're joined by an expert panel to discuss ETF strategies and generating alpha using factors. We're joined by Andrew Klee, VP ETFs at Fidelity Investments Canada, Jing Hong, Director ETF Sales and Trading at BMO Capital Markets, and Andreas Reinkon, Director ETFs and Derivatives at TD Securities. Speaking with host Dave Bushnell, our expert panel discusses what's been happening in the ETF landscape throughout 2020, as well as the fastest growing trends in the market, how to individualize an ETF strategy, and maximizing ETFs to tackle ongoing market volatility. This podcast was recorded on June 11th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Thank you all very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Andrew, I'd like to kick the first question over to you. We always like to start off our ETF broadcast with just a general update on what's happening in the ETF landscape, and if you could touch on both Canada and US.
Sure. So I think I always like to look back historically, kind of the months prior. So as you recall, a couple of weeks ago we were on here, we were looking at the April flows, and they weren't fantastic. The ETF industry in Canada brought in about $650 million, which is fairly light when you look at the historical average. But May looks like a big bounce back month. So we brought in nearly $2.5 billion, and it was largely a risk on trade. So we saw a ton of money go into the equity market, and specifically it found a home in international equity, which brought over $1 billion. We haven't seen that lead the pack in a while. So I think it is encouraging that we're starting to see a bit of a risk on trade through the month of last month.
Thanks, Andrew. Jing, I'll go to you. Any additional comments?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo quite a lot of what Andrew said. You know, in both the U.S. and Canada, we've seen some strong demand for international developed markets. The U.S. certainly has led. In Canada, we're starting to see institutions start to nibble away at emerging market exposure. And fixed income inflows remain very strong, both sides of the border.
Thanks, Jing. Andreas, anything to add?
Just for sure. I agree and echo their message already. We've seen a risk-on environment going into the last few weeks. If you look at on the equity side, for example, we've seen a move or start to move to value and small caps. So on the flow side, for example, we've seen quite a bit of flows go into the small cap names. And on performance, we've seen, for example, small caps outperform all the large caps, and we've seen value outperform growth there too. If you go down to the sectors, it's even more substantial, the outperformance there. So if you look at the financials, for example, the discretionary, those names have actually outperformed quite a bit, the utilities, the staples and whatnot. So we've seen quite a bit of a push there. And if you go to the fixed income side, obviously when you get high yield outperforming investment grade consistently, it's something that we obviously pay quite a bit of attention to. So overall, yes, for sure, a move towards risk on has been the trend over the last 2 weeks, I'd say.
Interesting. Thank you. Jing, I'd like to go back to you for the next question. You spend a big part of your day working with financial advisors and obviously talking to them about the markets. Are there any particular conversations or themes that you're having right now?
Specifically with advisors, you know, the conversation is just very much around education. So they always want to know what's happening in respective asset classes, particularly the ones that saw a lot of volatility, I would say, over the last 3 months. It changes quite a lot. Of recent, we've had lots of conversations around commodity-based ETFs in Canada as guys are trying to, you know, figure out what the best mechanism to gain exposure to that asset class is and understanding the pricing.
Interesting. Andreas, can I go to you with the same question, please?
For sure. Look, when advisors approach my group to talk about ETFs, They want to know what the risks are, like what's in the ETF, what's under the hood of this ETF. Tell me about it. At the end of the day, we are the experts within TD when it comes to ETFs, so they come to us to know exactly what can get them in trouble. That's their main concern there, right? Their clients, to make sure that their clients' assets are safe. So that's number one. And number two is how to trade this ETF, right? We know best as a market maker, the tradability of that ETF. So, you know, they have concerns about it. Can they go in? Can they go out? Is it liquid enough, given the size or whatever it is? So we, you know, we get a lot of those questions and we talk to our advisors quite often about those topics.
Andreas, I'd like to ask you a follow-up question to that. Andrew Klee and I have talked many times on Fidelity Connects before about how the buying of an ETF and the buying of a mutual fund really should be done with the same due diligence process. So to your point, looking under the hood, would you echo those comments, or do you see that there perhaps is in some different things you might look at when looking at, say, an ETF compared to a mutual fund?
No, we would say it's similar. At the end of the day, they're the same assets that are within those funds, if it's the same fund, obviously. So we will look at it and say, look, if it's the same asset, I'm not sure why you would look at one over the other. Obviously, there are differences between the two, and that one trades in the public markets, the other one doesn't. But that's a different story. When it comes to due diligence, I would say it would be very similar.
Last follow-up on this topic. Jing mentioned she's getting some comments on the commodity side of things, or some interest. Are you seeing anything in commodities or any other areas of interest?
Yeah, for sure. It's gold. Gold has been an area that's picked up quite a bit of interest, and we're seeing quite a bit of like buying in these ETFs. The question is always about, do I buy the producers or do I buy the commodity itself? And that's where most of the conversation is going. But if you look at the performance of our quant model, for example, on the ETF side, gold has been a great addition to the portfolio and provider of alpha for those portfolios. So that's an area that we continue to look at. And from a value perspective, now you're seeing a lot of these smaller names in the gold space kind of start to add value to those portfolios. So a lot of people are talking about moving to the smaller cap gold names, let's say.
Interesting. Thank you. Andrew, I'll go to you. Any final thoughts on that topic?
No, I think we get similar questions, even though we're not in the commodity space. I think there's a lot of discussion. Just granted, we did see oil prices go negative not too short period ago, and some ETFs did get in trouble there. But I think that's key to understanding when you're looking under the hood, knowing that some ETFs track derivatives, for example, and not necessarily the physical commodity. So to Andreas's point, in Canada, in the gold space, there are a handful of ETFs that track physical gold bullion, which I do think is a benefit because it does take some of that derivative risk away from the underlying.
Thanks, General. I want to change gears a little bit, and Andreas and Jing, and Jing, I'll go back to you to start this off. We talk a lot about the difference between retail and institutional, and both of you work in both sides. Are you seeing any trends right now, Jing, in the institutional landscape that are of interest?
Certainly. There are probably, the overarching theme, I would say, is the institutional uptake of fixed income ETFs. You know, this has certainly been a conversation that we've had for many years. We continue to see it as a huge growth area that has so far in Canada been largely dominated by retail investors. And in addition to bringing new guys to the table in terms of allocating, you know, portfolio, model portfolios towards fixed income ETFs as opposed to cash bonds, the conversation is also elevating with existing users that are looking to apply a little bit more leverage in this low rate environment. So thinking of alternative ways to gain exposure to fixed income ETFs other than just straight out buying the ETF.
Jake, I'd like to follow up, and you somewhat answered this, but I'd love for you to expand. They're replacing what? Is it replacing cash? Is it replacing people building their own fixed income portfolio security by security? Or what would the ETFs be replacing?
I think the question really is, what couldn't it be replacing, right? So we're seeing a lot of tactical model, you know, shifts out of equity into fixed income at the beginning of the quarter, where everybody was getting a little bit more defensive and we had a little bit of panic selling, to be quite honest. But we're seeing vehicles employ, you know, money that was on the sidelines now go towards very short duration kind of yieldy products that are just, you know, in this environment, pretty meaningful pickup. And thirdly, we are also seeing institutions start to leverage the ETF vehicle as a means to translate their current cash fixed income exposure into ETF fixed income exposure, which gives them added liquidity, flexibility, and on balance kind of index exposure as opposed to single name exposure, which was a big concern in March for a lot of investors.
I'm curious if you could expand. Do you think that they're doing this more to get out of the fix for the liquidity or to eliminate the single name risk? Would you say one takes precedent over the other?
That's a great question. I think a lot of the conversation right when COVID started impacting the markets was certainly single name risk. It was a huge concern for a lot of books. But I think as soon as kind of tempers calmed down a little bit and we started to get legs beneath the credit markets once again, it really opened up the conversation and into improved liquidity because advisors can see a lit market. Or institutions can see a lit market in fixed income ETFs, whereas the cash bond market remains non-transparent. And they have, you know, been shown now that there are quite a lot of market makers in the space that are providing ongoing and meaningful liquidity to the space. So the concern of execution really isn't there like it was a few years ago when this market was just starting to take off in Canada.
Jing, last question on this, and you mentioned rebalancing. I was curious if you could go into that. Have you seen institutions do typically more rebalancing, obviously with the current volatility? Have they sort of stuck to their knitting, or have you seen people perhaps rebalance at a higher frequency than you're used to?
I would say on an institutional level, we've actually seen that dial down, and I think it was a lot of accounts just waiting to see what actually happened. They realized that there was a huge overreaction in the market. They needed to get more stability. And it seemed like every week they were coming into the office, a different asset class was falling off the chair. So now we're starting to see a few more meaningful allocations towards certain ETFs. But I don't think in Canada we have seen the model allocation rebalances like we have in the U.S. just yet, which doesn't surprise me because Canada at times does lag the U.S.
Thanks, Jing. Andreas, I'd like to go to you with the same line of questioning, activity that you're seeing on the institutional side of things.
Well, one, obviously, the fixed income side is a big area that we've seen a big shift there. But one area that we like to talk about and we've seen quite a bit is that move from tactical to core use. So the traditional institutional manager would go to an emerging market ETF just for your like small portion of play here in this region or some specific area that ETFs were really good at. So that was kind of the original stepping stone of how an institution would get into an ETF. But now you see a lot of these ETFs use, a lot of these institutions use ETFs as their core position. So they would go and use an EFI ETF or in some cases, a lower vol ETF or something along those lines that provides exposure that they want as a core part of their position. And you would see the same thing on the fixed income side. I think on the fixed income side, it's actually grown quite rapidly too. You're now seeing, for example, LQD, HYG, these are ETFs that are being used as core positions for many managers, right? And so I think that will definitely continue. That's one trend that we're seeing. The other trend is ESG. ESG has been a big area for corporations and also for institutions. Retail, I would say they're still trying to figure out where you can fit ESG within a portfolio. And I think portfolio construction is a bigger issue there and how to fit it. But for ESG, it's become institutions have used ESG quite a bit and it's growing quite rapidly. So you're seeing a lot of launches of products that are directed towards a specific institutional investor or a couple of institutional investors. And that's where we see a lot of that growth there.
Andreas, that's a really interesting point. I was wondering if we could expand on that a little bit. It seems to me that the ESG has really resonated in Europe. Like it seems that it's really resonated there. Do you see it coming across the ocean? Are American firms adapting this more on the institutional side? Is Canada adapting it more? How do you see it really evolving over here? Because I'm with you. It seems that over there you read a lot about it, and it seems like it's growing here, but not at that same pace.
Yeah, I would agree with you. It's definitely growing in North America. I'm going to just talk about North America in general. I think there are huge differences between the U.S. and Canada when it comes to ESG specifically. There are firms in the U.S. that have been very large firms that have been very aggressive towards shifting their models towards ESG, being more ESG-like. And in Canada, you also have several institutions that have also adapted more ESG metrics. I think that is an area of growth and it will continue to grow. And look, if you're looking at it from all the institutions, all corporations, that's basically half of what they're talking about these days. Obviously, COVID interrupted that conversation. But pre-COVID, I would say a big chunk of the conversations that our CEOs, a big chunk of the conversations that the heads of mutual fund companies were, they were talking about ESG quite a bit. So I think, once things come back to normal, hopefully soon, ESG will once again be at the forefront of the conversation.
Interesting. Andrew Klee, can we turn it over to you for final comments on this topic?
Yeah, I would agree and echo the comments that Andreas said. I'd say North America is certainly behind Europe. When you look at the trends in the Scandinavian countries, Norway specifically, Sweden, they've had massive, massive uptick in ESG. And a lot of these institutions are getting exposure through UCITS ETFs, which are our European cousins to North American ETFs, just a slightly different structure. And then you've also seen the trend in Canada. So I don't know if you've noticed the new issue market. Or the new launch market in the ETF space. Fidelity came with an ESG ETF last year, but we've also seen a number of competitors launch ESG suites. So I think if you look at that trend, I think it does continue. And we're probably a few years behind the European markets, but that is an area that I think will explode. And then if you look at how ESG behaved through COVID, it actually did quite well with the majority of ESG funds outperforming the broad index. So I think now we're starting to view, is ESG a factor that is similar to value or momentum? And I think the jury's still out whether ESG is a factor by itself, but something that we've done in our own research with our quants down in Boston, Bobby Barnes and Michael Robertson, is ESG, while the jury might be out on whether that's a factor premium like value, it does tend to lead to high quality. And there's a lot of research that suggests that high quality companies do have an alpha proposition over the long.
Andrew, you bring up an interesting point that I'd love you to just expand on. The traditional thought, if I can say that, on ESG has been that perhaps there could be lackluster performance as a result of the screens you have to use. But to your point, through the most recent volatility, the exact opposite has been shown. Do you see that as propelling it either on the institutional or retail side, now that obviously there's more proof that these mandates really can add value?
Well, I think ESG's evolved. So if we rewind about a decade and we think about how ESG was, it was predominantly exclusionary. So what that meant was we will not invest in energy. We will not invest in mining companies. And what I would say over the recent years is you've seen the emergence of a best-in-class approach because there's acknowledgement in the market that, for example, oil is not going away. And if you actually look at the R&D that a company like Royal Dutch Shell or Exxon or Chevron, some of those major oil companies, invest from a research and development standpoint in clean energy, they're the largest companies in the world that are actually researching this space, trying to make it sustainable because they've acknowledged, hey, oil is not the cleanest thing and we need to be in business 50 years down the road, 20 years down the road. So they're starting to look to diversify there. So best in class tends to reward companies that are investing in research efforts like this. So what I would say is the concern was that if I don't own a certain sector, I've now handcuffed myself. But ESG's evolved, so you might slightly invest in energy. So for example, in our ESG, there's about a 3-5% weight on best-in-class energy companies. And if you look at kind of the R&D budgets that those oil companies have, they're larger in aggregate than the market cap of all solar stocks. But we're starting to look at a best-in-class approach, and that kind of takes away the handcuffs so you can add both alpha while doing well by the environment and social governance standpoint.
Fantastic. Jing, I'd like to go back up to you, and I'd like to change gears a little bit. Trading of ETFs. So I was wondering if you could comment, how do we trade them, as in are there certain times of the day that's better or more optimal to be trading ETFs? I'd also hope you could comment, how has trading ETFs been in, I'll say, the last 40 days? Obviously, a lot of market volatility, a question that we do get asked a lot, is on liquidity. Can you comment on that?
Sure. So let me go backwards. the last 40 days have certainly been a lot more stable. You know, a lot of the chaos that we saw in March was incubated as a reaction to a global pandemic, and as well as all these geographies adapting to remote working. So we've never seen something like that before in the history of financial markets. And so that certainly got exacerbated. Right now, I would say markets more or less reflect what they were liquidity-wise, you know, pre-COVID. And what's truly astounding is that this is actually being done remotely as well. Now, is quoting slightly slower? Perhaps, because now every single market maker has to jump through a few more hoops in order to communicate with one another. But, you know, I can speak for BMO, our trading systems are stable as ever. We're running quite a lot of backup systems, and we're doing what we need to put our team in the right place geographically to ensure stability. As well, asset classes are gaining a lot more stability as well. Like, credit markets have improved markedly. Throughout March, we were certainly doing most of our trading in fixed income, and that tone hasn't really changed either recently. But what we have seen a pickup in the last 40 days is new issuance. So, you know, part of my job would be to talk to new issuers as they're coming to market with new product, such as the Fidelities of the world with their launch yesterday. And, you know, really starting to see that healthy new issuance market come back is kind of a testament to the confidence that all the market participants have in the space and the markets. With respect to trading, I wish I had an answer for what is the optimal time to trade, because the simple answer is it's extremely complex and really will depend on the asset class. We are so fortunate in Canada that we've got a very healthy ETF space that pretty much tracks every asset class and every geography by now. So really, it depends on the actual fund itself. So whether the advisor can apply, you know, a bit of acumen themselves, or if they need to lean on to their special handling desk or a market maker to advise on the best times, especially if we're dealing with an order size that we would qualify as a block order, you really do want to be leaning on the industry experts to determine what the liquidity of that asset class is that day, what's the best time. You know, there are obvious metrics, like certainly when international markets are closed, but I think one that often gets overlooked, and we see it time and time again, is that Canadian fixed income markets close for half the day prior to every Canadian holiday. And yet, without fail, we always see all of our retail fixed income flow come in the afternoon right before holidays. I would strongly urge advisors to be a little bit more wary around closed markets locally as well. And if you can, try to trade those fixed income ETFs in the morning prior to 1 p.m. ahead of, you know, civic long weekend. Another thing I would advise is if you take a look at, you know, trading multiple ETFs all in one go, if you happen to be buying and selling, it might be beneficial to be trading those at the same time, because perhaps those risks are very meaningful as offsets to a market maker who might be quoting you a market, and that could also improve your execution. I should have said this one first, but no market orders whatsoever. It just subjects yourself to unknown price execution risk that you do not need to take on. So put any kind of a limit on it, even if it's a few cents off the bid or the offer, that will protect you against the downside. And last but not least, we are seeing a significant uptick, in NAV-based trading, both in retail as well as institutional. This is kind of where the ETF looks more like a mutual fund, and it provides a lot of flexibility to getting fair value pricing at the end of the day, and it's entirely possible, especially given the fact that Canadian ETFs don't have an MOC facility. We're seeing a lot more accounts employ this.
Perfect. Thank you. Andrew, Clea, I'd like to go to you, changing gears again a little bit. Factors right now, you even mentioned, I thought it was interesting, ESG perhaps being its own factor. Can you walk us through how you're seeing factor rotation right now.
Sure. So I think factor investing, so we can call it style investing, factor investing, smart beta. There's a lot of terminology in the market. And I think investors have been doing this since the dawn of time. So we all know Benjamin Graham, kind of the father of value investing. He trained Warren Buffett, who would classify himself probably as a value investor. And then we have high quality, we have low volatility, we have momentum. So if we're believers that markets are not efficient, so that's essentially what Fidelity was based on, active management or quantitative factor investing, we're trying to exploit the market inefficiencies. And the belief is that all these factors that we have offered in the market and have done research on over very long time periods have historically outperformed the market. But that doesn't mean they outperform all the time. So that means there can be short-term, medium-term underperformance and outperformance. And so what we like to think of as a world is you have three horizons, and I kind of bring it back to the ocean. So you have the tide. That's your 10 to 20-year view, your long-term view. Is there a structural trend in place that is going to allow a factor to outperform? So if you look back through history, right now, the past 13 years have been a growth market. Growth stocks have beaten value stocks. But similarly, if you look from 2000 to 2007, value outperformed growth. So those are the tides that you want to jump on. Make sure you don't have that, miss that trend. Then we have what we call waves. So those would be your kind of business cycle moves, those 2 to 3 year moves where a factor may outperform or underperform. And you should pay attention to them because a wave can knock over your boat, but it's not as important as catching the tide. And lastly, you have the ripples, and that's the short-term noise, so the daily moves. We want everyone to kind of ignore those ripples, because if you look, Andreas and Jing highlighted value has outperformed for about the last 2 weeks. Today, value is underperforming. So you really want to take that view. And what we're seeing in today's market is the value trade is on. We have a number of our quants down in Boston, specifically Bobby Burns, who's very excited about value. But when we think about bringing funds to market, we most recently launched Value and Momentum. Value, while underperforming the last few weeks, we're starting to see a rotation into the market where a lot of those large players are selling some growth stocks, picking up some small cap and some value. So we're pretty excited now that we have all the factors in the market, because we can help you address those needs, whether it's that 10 to 15 year trend where I'd say, if you're a client that needs income, even though dividends are underperforming, that's a great position if that's your long-term goal. We can also help you with those short-term waves to say where we see opportunity. So something we're pretty excited about right now is the value factor specifically, just given the opportunity relative to history. So we saw some decent volume. Yesterday was our first day of launch, but we put up about $1 million between the momentum and the value factors. So we're pretty excited to see that support on day one, and we'd like to thank you all for that.
Thank you, Andrew. And that, I think we could keep going with this panel all day, but that unfortunately brings us to a close. I'd like to thank Andrew, Andreas, and Jim for their time today. That was a great conversation. But thank you to everyone for tuning in, and we look forward to welcoming all of you back on Fidelity Connects. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.